Hey everyone, welcome to Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris. Thanks for tuning in. You can go to the website, which is nowheretorunradio.com. My guest today is Barry Chamish. His website is barrychamish.com. He's an Israeli investigative reporter and author who has done a lot of work in investigating not just the modern state of Israel and what is going on and the truth behind a lot of the disinformation, but he's also done a lot of work as far as the history of Israel. And what we're going to be talking about today is first and foremost debunking a lot of the myths that people believe about Israel and Judaism in particular. But also in doing that, we actually went really deep into the history of Sabbataism and the history of Zionism. And as much as I thought I knew and as much as a lot of people probably think that they know about the history of Israel, it's a great deal more complicated and more interesting than I certainly ever believed. And it really helps you give a perspective of what's going on. And I think that you will be fascinated by this, but I'll let Barry pick it up from here. Here we go. Wanted to have you on was to debunk some of the common ideas that a lot of people have as they begin to search out the truths about what's going on in the world and stuff like that. And there seems to be more disinformation about the Israel connection than there is about really any other topic. So I just want to hit some of the more common ones first and just get your reaction about some of them. The first one would be the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, as it's called, which is lauded as a blueprint for the New World Order and about how to control the masses. And of course, it was used by Hitler and the Nazi regime to say that the Jews were behind a lot of the things that were going on. What's your reaction to that?
I don't believe it was used by Hitler. It was used by the Tsar, by the Russians. They used it to justify everything it said. It was also used by Henry Ford. The Nazis had other things to go with. But you can look this up yourself. You go on the internet to look for the sources of the protocols, and you'll find, the very first time it appeared was in France, in 1837. There's a later date as well in the 1860s, but everyone agrees it's a French document. And you have to, I'm going to stick with the 1837. I mean, my goodness, you go back as far as it goes, it's 1837 in France. Now, you got to realize there was no Zionism in 1837. The Zionism that eventually got Israel back was in the 1880s in Germany and in Vienna. That's when even the word was invented. So this document just simply was not a blueprint for the Zionist takeover of anything. It didn't even exist. There was no Council of Zion. What there was in France, this is a theory, but it makes a lot of sense. There was the Priory of Zion, which, again, it's not my research, but it's become very popular through the Da Vinci Code. I knew about it well before the Da Vinci Code, but it was popularized that there was something that was controlling probably Europe. It was blackmailing the Vatican. Well, this was the Priory of Zion. And if anything, these protocols were a satire, which is how they were viewed when they came out, of the Priory of Zion. There was no Zionism. And you'll note, the word Jew doesn't appear in the protocols. That's not the claim of these. There was supposedly the learners of the elders of Zion who said they were Jews. There's a real chance that they were French and they were Catholic.
Sure. And it seems like it was pretty commonly understood that satire was about Napoleon. And then you can actually kind of follow how that was changed by the Tsar, by the Russians and things like that to add to it the Jewish connection and things like that.
Well, I've never heard Napoleon, but remember, Napoleon was finished in 1816. That was the end of him, and this didn't come out at least till 1837. So I don't necessarily buy that interpretation. Nonetheless, it was viewed as a satire of something.
Okay, fair enough. All right, moving on to the Arthur Koestler. He basically this
Arthur
is
Koestler and
well first if you could explain what the theory is generally before discussing it.
Well, it's not a theory. This is rabid anti-Semitism, which the Jews don't understand. No idea why this is being used. Arthur Koestler wrote a book called The 13th Tribe. Koestler was Israeli. He wrote about kibbutzim and all kinds of things. And he wrote an entertaining speculative book. And he would just be turning over in his grave if he saw that American anti-Semites took this thesis and turned it into all Ashkenazi Jews are from Khazaria. Now, there was a state called Khazaria. How Jewish it was is very much up for grabs. The people certainly weren't Jewish. The royal family did convert, I believe, from what I read, and I've read well beyond Koestler. I read his sources before I even read Koestler. I thought it was always a fascinating thing that there was an independent Jewish state in Central Asia beginning the 8th century. I thought that was a terrific bit of history. But what the anti-Semites have done is that they've turned the Khazarians into a massive wave of immigrants who took over Western and Eastern Europe and became Ashkenazi Jews. And it's not even good amateur historical reading of Koestler's book. What it comes down to in this day and age, we have DNA sampling. There are traits that are Jewish in the DNA. And you go to Google and you write Jewish DNA and read it for yourself. Jews, Sephardic and Ashkenazi, share many common strands of or genomes. I'm not a biologist, but this is what I've read. That joins both Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews in a very distant past. None of the genes, none of them come from Khazaria. And in fact, what they're finding is there are Jewish genes in place. Very high percentage of the Spanish people, for instance, are Jewish because they were forced converted and they entered the population, and they share the Jewish genes. But lo and behold, no one in Khazaria shares Jewish genes. This is just utter ignorance. And even before the DNA was developed, my goodness, the Yiddish language predated. It began in the 9th century in Germany, and it became the language of the Jews. There isn't a word from Khazarian in Yiddish. And if the masses of Khazarians took over Western and Eastern Europe, there'd be some Khazarian left over in the language they spoke. I mean, it's really a very idiotic way of thinking. And by the way, anyone who buys into it, who cares? Let's say they're right. I could care less that I'm from Khazaria. It just doesn't matter to Jews. And calling them Khazarians means nothing to a Jew. But these anti-Semites, they've got a new code word. The Khazarians are the ones who have taken over the world, and they're not even Jewish. They're not related to Abraham. And what could you say? I mean, the whole thing is, if it weren't so poorly thought out and so dumb, it would actually be humorous. But you've got some vicious anti-Semites who somehow have turned this into the latest craze in anti-Semitism. The Jews are from Eastern, from Central Asia, and aren't really Jews, therefore let's hate them. It's very, very hard to make logical sense out of this. And as I said, Israelis don't even know it exists.
Right. I'll save that one for later. So okay, let's move on to the other one. I think that was a good explanation of that. Now, this is a little bit more contemporary. The concept portrayed in the media is that Israel is constantly bulldozing Palestinian homes that have been there forever to build settlements. Is that true? What do you think about that common perception?
Unfortunately, it's not true. I would love to see more settlements, and I'd love to see fewer Palestinian homes. But there hasn't been. The Israeli government sure bulldozes Jewish homes all the time. You put up a spare bedroom, there's no permit, and they come and bulldoze Jewish homes. I can't recall even after terror attacks. When the families' homes were bulldozed as a way of preventing the next terror attack, I can't recall it being done in the last 20 years.
So, do you agree or disagree that there was such a thing as a Palestinian state before that
Let's say
Jewish?
agree, or this is not a question of agreeing or disagreeing. There was no Palestine. This is not an issue. It was a province. Actually, it was two vilayets of the Ottoman Empire. They were part of actually the province of Syria. There has never been a nation called Palestine. I mean, that's obvious. And now, as for twisting history, you have to look at the Ottomans beginning in the 1880s, actually filling up this area with Muslims, and by the way, from very strange places like Bosnia and Herzegovina and Kazakhstan. The Ottomans moved Muslims into what was essentially a very empty place, and we've got so many records, and also the observers in the 19th century went on very rough tourist holidays to the Holy Land. Big names like Balzac and Mark Twain, and I mean they all said the place was empty, that was in desperate paucity of people, and then suddenly in the 1880s. The Turks start bringing in people, and they become the ancient Palestinians. You have to look, this is a very weird history, but the British decided that they were Jews in the 1860s, and by the mid-1880s, the first Zionism had actually begun in Europe, based really. I mean, it comes back to haunt us, the British Israelites, but the Zionists began in German-speaking countries, and by the 1880s, the first wave, 2,000 people was the wave, of returning Jews came from Europe at the same time the Turks didn't like it one little bit. Now, I could actually tell a pretty good story of the rivalry between the British and the Germans over Jerusalem, and this is very, very central to what's happening today. But the key of the matter is the Jews historically have returned to their land, and the Palestinians were moved to the new land of Palestine by the Ottoman Turks. And you have to look at the demographics. There was one book that really examined the demographic surveys of the 19th century Palestine, and that was Joan Peters from Time Immemorial. I mean, that book has been really, I think I'm repressed, but that book has really been hidden from the general public. But if you read it, it's approximately what I'm saying now, is the place was empty and then suddenly it got filled. And so this demographic war over Israel was a war between the German Ottomans. Well, I'm not going to do this unless I tell the whole story. And right now we're not telling the whole story. The Ottomans just filled up Palestine while Europe tried to get Zionism started. And this is the mess that we live with today. And again, if you give me the time, but building up to this mess is a very complicated story.
Right. Well, that's about as good as a thumbnail of that as possible. And I really thank you for figuring out how to do that. And that ties into really the next basic question. It will probably be the last question that I'm going to ask you, but there's so much that needs to be built up.
That's it? After this, the interview's over?
No, well, I don't think that'll be up to where you want to take it. Because the question essentially is a broad one, which is that it seems that what, you know, some people call the Illuminati, the New World Order, do have a actual hatred for Jews, but to all appearances, Jews have a disproportionate role in the Illuminati. This is a quote essentially from, I think, Makow, so how do you account for that apparent contradiction?
Yeah, well, listen, don't take – I've known Henry Makow for a long time, and if he made that statement, look, the research – it's very, very hard to come by. And there's a lot of speculation out there. But one way or another, I became friends with people who understood the real deep background of what Makow calls the Illuminati. He's got completely wrong. The Illuminati is an organization that is not Jewish, and it's very Catholic, and its goal is to bring Christendom back to Rome. It's got nothing to do with Jews, and what Makow did again was just use a cliched term, like people know what the Illuminati was.
Okay. Let me just kind of guide as far as the question goes, just to make sure we're on the same page. What I want to take that is
there are no Jews in the Illuminati.
Okay. Well, what my question is in order to really understand the general concept of how what appears to be Zionism and what appears to be what we call Zionism and all these things about the history of the state of Israel in connection to what you have done, probably the most research on, which is, or at least as far as that I can find out there on Sabbataism. And in order to really understand it all, I need to have you, if you could, explain in the context of, history of Israel.
I've got you. All right. There are plenty of Jews, in the Jewish Illuminati, which is Sabbataism. Now, again, back to the Illuminati. The Illuminati is Catholic. It was founded by Adam Weishaupt, and its purpose was to muck up the standard bearers, mostly of the Protestant Reformation, but also the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Jews. Anyone who did not accept Romans, the center of religion was going to be conspired against. That was the Illuminati. The Jews played almost no role in the Illuminati, but they had their own version of the Illuminati called Sabbataism. And to understand that, I have to go all the way back to why it's called Sabbataism. You sure you want to do this? It's a long story.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. So let's just go.
All right. There was a false messiah named Shabtai Tzvi. Sabbataism in the Hebrew is Shabtaiism. Somehow in English it became Sabbataism. It's not my fault. It's wrong, but that's what we're stuck with. Shabtai Tzvi on June 18th of 1666, declared that the Messianic age had now begun because He was the Messiah. The problem was it was accepted by the majority of Jews, and I mean all over the world. All the quote I always use is used everywhere somehow, from Iran to Mexico. Now, again, when you're talking about accepted, when the Messiah arrives, well, what did Jews do? They sold all their property for a penny on the dollar. They climbed hilltops, and they expected to be transported to the New Jerusalem. This was happening all over Europe. Shabtai Tzvi was, for a very brief time, the Messiah of the Jews. If you didn't know that, now you do. There's nothing more I can do about it. That piece of history has been rubbed out of the history books. One of the most important, certainly the Jewish history books barely touch on it, but this is what happened. And by the way, June 18th of 1666 had to have been chosen by the Vatican, lest we miss the point. June is the 6 month, and 18 is 6 times 3, and 1666 we know about. That was the date he chose to be the Messiah, and that was the day the Jews worldwide made asses of themselves. Now, without diving in too deeply, Sabbateanism was anti-Judaism. What Shabtai Tzvi taught is that everything in the Torah is true in the opposite sense. In other words, well, do not adulter becomes adulter like a pig. Do not kill means do kill. And that led directly to the Holocaust, by the way, to give you a little, I forgot my literary term, when we mentioned something well before we're going to hit it head on.
Foreshadowing?
Why not? Foreshadowing. That's the word. Yeah, that led to the Holocaust. As the music goes bum bum, and the film goes on, yeah, Sabbateanism led to directly to the greatest repression of Jews.
Because, I'm sorry to stop you there. I want you to, if you could, touch a little bit on the idea that Shabtai Tzvi was. It's kind of an esoteric sort of Kabbalistic idea, you know, and there was...
No, it wasn't esoteric at all. It was very straightforward. The Torah is a true in its opposite sense. In other words, whatever a blessing is in the Torah now becomes a sin, and whatever sin now becomes a blessing.
And in your research, did you find – I was reading some accounts of Shabtai Tzvi, and this is in 1666, so, I mean, it was – there is, you know, accounts of this guy.
There are lots of accounts.
And they talk a lot about this shining face and all these things that were happening, very miracles. I mean, there had to be some reason why people were thinking the guy was, you know, the Messiah. So is it mostly –
Yeah, the Jews were desperate. They were waiting for a Messiah. Obviously – the promotion, I believe the Vatican promoted this guy for their own purposes. In other words, who else had the agents in the 17th century to spread the word of Shabtai Tzvi worldwide in such a short time? But neither here nor there, we don't have the proof of that, so I'm not going to harp on it.
All right.
Now the issue of Shabtai Tzvi was forgotten in the Jewish world when the Turkish Sultan had enough and forced Shabtai Tzvi to convert to Islam. That was it for most Jews worldwide. They realized they'd been fooled and Shabtai Tzvi was rubbed out of history, but not for all. There was a cult in Turkey. Shabtai Tzvi, incidentally, was Turkish. There was a cult in Turkey called the Donma, which believed that their Messiah's conversion to Islam was in fact prophetic, and that's where they would take their movement. They would join other religions and pretend initially to be Muslim. Later on, to be Catholic in anything, but they would remain Sabbatean. And this is, I'm gonna stop here, and I'm gonna foreshadow again, or we're gonna be lost. The Council on Foreign Relations is controlling American diplomacy. In recent days, the following members of the Council on Foreign Relations, in let's say the last decade, are given remarkable positions of power, and some journalist looks them up, and lo and behold, John Kerry is a Jew. John Kerry didn't know that his father was a Czech Jew. He forgot it. Everyone thought he was Irish Catholic, and it turns out his father is a Czech Jew. Madeleine Albright doesn't know that she was raised by two Jewish parents and spent World War II in her cousin's Jewish cousin's home in London. She forgot all this. Wesley Clark forgot his father was a Jew as he's bombing the hell out of Bosnia. If you look at the number of fake Jews that have come out of the Council on Foreign Relations, you'll understand that Sabbateanism is extremely relevant to your lives. Extremely. But now let's go back to the Dharma cult. They kept Sabbateanism alive. And apparently in Turkey, from my sources, it runs the place. Certainly the founder of modern Turkey, Atatürk, was a Sabbatean. I try not to say Sabbatean Jew, because they are the worst enemy the Jews ever had. They despise Judaism, but, well, we can foreshadow a little more. Israel was founded by Sabbateans. There, we jumped forward a whole lot that the labor Zionism, not every other kind of Zionism, there were lots of very good strands of Zionism, including religious Zionism and the Zionism I certainly still believe in. It was called revisionist Zionism, or the, what you would now call Likud, which is completely wrong. Zionism, but labor Zionists were Sabbateans, and they were vicious. These people took over the Zionist movement like no one else existed and founded Israel, and they did horrific stuff to the Jews. Forget the Arabs. That's not even of interest to me. It's what they did to the Jews and their role in the Holocaust, which is very serious, by the way. That's disturbing to me. But let's get back to Shabtai Tzvi. He converts to Islam. It's viewed as prophetic, and now you've got a movement going called Sabbateanism. When it really hit Europe, was about 80 years later, when the second Messiah was born, and that was Jacob Frank. Jacob Frank converted thousands of Jews to Catholicism. At least that's what he told the bishop. In actual fact, he converted them to Sabbateanism, and becoming a Catholic was standard practice. He was a tremendously sneaky guy who founded Sabbateanism in Europe, and we now have two messiahs. We have Shabtai Tzvi, that's Sabbateanism, and we have Yaakov Frank, that's called Frankism. And if you ask an Israeli about Sabbateanism, they know nothing. But the older people all know about Frankism, all of them. He's a Frankist, means something in Israel, not to the younger generation, but to the older generation, it meant labor Zionist. That's what it meant.
So if you could also, before we kind of go into some of the history about the founding of of Israel at this point.
We're not even getting close to Israel, or it won't make sense. Well, Israel is much later.
if you could hit the Frankfurt connection in Germany, I think that's an important tie-in.
Well, I was heading there. I mean, you can't really ignore it. Jacob Frank created, well, what he created was a nest of spies. He would take the new Catholics, and they were now allowed into the higher levels of European society. They were now Christians, and he would take advantage of this, gather facts, gather rumors. He would muck up countries and stir up the people, and he was a real troublemaker, but he ran out of money. All the histories of Jacob Frank say that around 1778-9, the organization was, well, miraculously well-founded. But in 1780, there wasn't a penny to be found for Frankism. Now, what happened, and by the way, all the histories say the same thing, that in 1785, Jacob Frank moved his court to Frankfurt, Germany, and became extremely wealthy. By 1786, Frankism was suddenly a force with money. Now, you have to look at Frankfurt, Germany in 1785-6 and see who was there. You have to know it was the conspiracy capital of mankind, was Frankfurt. Also in Frankfurt was Adam Weishaupt, the founder and leader of the Illuminati. Also in Frankfurt, and this is the one who joined the Illuminati to the Sabbateans, was Mayor Amschel Rothschild. That's where his court was, in the ghetto of Frankfurt. Now, Rothschild, I looked up the family history to try and make sense of this. Rothschild was not wealthy then. He was a coin trader with ambitions. After this meeting in Frankfurt between Jacob Frank, Adam Weishaupt, in, I believe, the home of Mayor Amschel Rothschild. It's a little tricky to narrow down all the facts, but everything changed for the world. Rothschild just wanted to make money, and he had five ambitious sons who came up with the very right conclusion that if you control a nation's finances, you control the nation. It was a brilliant conclusion, but you need money for that. Adam Weishaupt had only one goal in life. That was to get, the immediate goal was to get Christianity back to Rome, wipe out the Eastern Orthodox Church, wipe out the Protestants, have them in constant revolution, wipe out their royal families, the works. That was the Illuminati. Meanwhile, Jacob Frank had the same awful goal, infiltrate the Jews and turn them into Sabbateans. It was the same goal as the Illuminati goal, but against Jews. These people met, and, well, the triangle that we call the world conspiracy. What the New World Order, whatever names people call it, it was at that meeting, that first meeting, that the world changed for good. From this point on, you had revolutions everywhere.
So what you're saying is kind of, it was this in, I mean, Jacob Frank and the Sabbateanism, because of the nature of the of religion, they were both evil and had agents everywhere that were had already infiltrated so many different things.
At times they worked together. At times they worked across purposes. The Illuminati again, is the Vatican. Now, you can go all over the place and say it's not the Vatican, it's the Black Pope, it's the Jesuits. It doesn't matter. It's the Vatican. The Sabbateanism that became Zionism, that it became labor Zionism, and that was extremely bad for the Jews. Now, there's a history which we can skip or not skip, and that is how the movement grew and how its influence spread and this stuff, or we can go just to the point where Sabbateanism becomes labor Zionism. Remember, Zionism was a perfectly good movement of national liberation of the 19th century for a lot of people.
Well, let's start about the 1880s then. But if you could first kind of give some of your books up to this point that have explained some of the things that you've already talked about, and then where people can get them, and also your website for people can get your newsletter, because you apply a lot of this research to your newsletter as well. So if you can kind of give some of that out.
May as well, if I haven't got your listeners lost by now, they may as well go looking. My books. Now, in this case, the book that I wrote about Sabbateanism primarily is Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism and the Holocaust. And it's a really good book, available at lulu.com. That's lulu.com. There's a little search box. You punch in books and write in my name. Chamish. That's Chamish, and you'll get to my books. My latest one is The Compromised Land, which finishes with a tremendous flurry of Sabbateanism. So those are the two primary books, Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism and the Holocaust, and, The Compromised Land. My website is barrychamish.com, www.barrychamish.com. If you want to get on my website, there's a little thing that says Contact Barry, contact me, and from website you'll go onto news list. There, I think we've handled that.
Yep. Okay. And also for you can get the newsletter and all that stuff there too.
The newsletter. Well, it's pretty big. It's a few thousand people read me every time I write something, so I guess it has some purpose. And a lot of sites put up my material. So the word is kind of out, but nobody understands what I'm talking about. Now, Sabbateanism, I got my information from the two experts in the world living right now. One was Rabbi Marvin Antleman, who wrote the famous To Eliminate the Opiate about Sabbateanism. A very well-known conspiracy book. It's rated on all the conspiracy lists as one of the most influential books from that genre, and it's about Sabbateanism. And Rabbi Antleman used to phone me every week. He would have troubles with the real world. He couldn't understand the direction Israel was taking. Well, he phoned me for advice. So that was certainly an important source. And also I had a history professor from Oxford University, Avraham Ehrlich. Professor Ehrlich gave me tremendous research. So, you know, it's not cockamamie. These are very, very good scholars.
If I could interject too, there's a great deal of information on it. There's a lot of information on it. It's not like something that's just, you know, impossible to find information on Sabbateanism or Shabtai Tzvi, or it's out there. It's pretty recently. And also, I would mention on Rabbi Antleman, that guy is Jordan Maxwell, who is a conspiracy, is an anti-Semite, really, but that he uses so much of, like, Rabbi Antelman. He says to people that Rabbi Antelman told him, you know, whispered to his ear that, you know, all the whole Jewish thing never really happened. It's all a big myth, and there really was no King David, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, he did not.
He did. He does. He says all the time.
No, he can say that all he wants, but I know Rabbi Antelman now 30 years, and I know him intimately. And that is complete falsehood.
Right. Well, I addressed it a little bit in the Jordan Maxwell debunked video that I did. But anyway, so, okay, so continue where you're going there. Just want to interject.
How could he even make a statement like that? He's Rabbi Antelman is an Orthodox rabbi. All right. Well, then you've got to really not take Jordan Maxwell terribly seriously if he's prepared to lie like that. Rabbi Antelman is a religious Orthodox Jew who very seriously takes Judaism, and what he's worried about is Sabbateanism has infiltrated Judaism and created an atrocity for the Jewish people, and that's to eliminate the opiate. You know, you have to understand the motivations that I certainly share with Rabbi Antelman, but all kinds of other people. We're trying to save Judaism from something that has wormed its way inside our fiber, and we're trying to get it out because, first of all, it's extremely rotten and it's no good for the Jews in general to have this Sabbateanism wrapped around our necks. And, well, the motivation is to clean up Judaism, and nothing more, nothing less than cleaning up Judaism, and it's for preserving an Israeli state that isn't run by these Sabbateans. Okay, that's the motivation for my work. Well, part of it.
Right. So let's start off from the 1880s. What do we need to know?
Well, what we need to know is, first of all, Zionism began. Now, it began again in Germany, but, oh, Lord, we have to, you know, you're asking the big story of what happened to the Illuminati in Germany. It was discovered in the 17th, during the French Revolution, is what the history books say, and the Illuminati was banned, and they moved to London, they infiltrated British Freemasonry, and we're skipping over, you know, the real, how they spread the conspiracy worldwide. We haven't touched on that, how this little triangle, Illuminati Sabbateanism, with Rothschild money, spread this philosophy worldwide.
Well, let's do that. Do that.
I covered it. It to get to the bottom of that, it takes a long time. Let's just say that it's now spread worldwide. The key of the Sabbatean issue is Germany reestablished itself in London when the Illuminati were banned. And all these Sabbatean, and remember, don't mix up Illuminati and Sabbatean. They're two separate issues. I'm talking to Sabbateans now. What they did to dilute the Jews, they wanted to get rid of Judaism, and their first means was dilution. And if you look at American Jewish religious movements, they're all, well, they start in Germany, they establish themselves briefly in London, and then they're off to America to thoroughly dilute Judaism and take people away from their religion. The Reform movement, the conservative movement, they were all deliberately founded to, well, ultimately, to rid the world of Jews through assimilation.
So let me clarify, as the Sabbateans infiltrated, they created schools and things like that to kind of teach this new version of Judaism, but were the Jewish people buying it? Were they changing?
There were no schools. I mean, what you had were the Reform really preaching a non-spiritual Judaism where God didn't even play a role, and that is the majority of American Jews. It has nothing to do with Judaism. They did not teach Sabbateanism. The goal of the Sabbateans was to rid the world of these heathen Jews, and they would set up a state. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky. Here's where it gets very tricky. They, in the 1860s, in Britain, the British decided that they were Jews. You have to look up the British Israelite organizations of the 19th century, where Benjamin Disraeli came from. Look, in short, Zionism came up. Well, it wasn't Zionism. It was the British Israelites had a great idea. We can make the Sabbateans the only Judaism. All we have to do is get back Israel. Pure and simple, and seed it with Sabbatean blood and just change Judaism through Israel. Now, before we go on, if people don't know the early history of Israel and the kibbutzim, it was standard Sabbateanism. They would build children's houses so the children wouldn't see the parents at night switching partners constantly. It was a free love Sabbatean or political movement with labor Zionism. I could tell you stories about Golda Meir that you would find shocking. Literally spreading her legs on her office desk. And, you know, if you don't understand where David Ben-Gurion came from, he came from Turkey. He left Russia, he went to Turkey, took on Turkish citizenship, and went to Israel. Oh, boy, I could go through the whole list of the labor Zionists and their connection to the Donma in Turkey, but it just comes down. The idea was you get Israel back, you and the world's Jews will be inspired by Israel and will slowly, if not immediately, become Sabbatean. But, again, you had good Zionism, and they had to be dealt with. And this is a very, very complex issue of why only the labor Zionists founded Israel. You know what? We're getting lost now. So well, let's do it.
Yeah, go ahead. Where do you want to go?
Let's do it chronologically. Remember, this, as strange as it seems, means that you have to abandon your reality. Everything you've been told has been a myth. Everything about the founding of Israel, in fact, it's way beyond the Jews. There was something controlling history that has been hidden for the longest time, and I face resistance. Well, in the case of the Jews, they think they know everything. They cannot change their reality, but it's pretty well the same amongst most people. Our reality was foisted on us, and our history was written by people who were conquering the world through their particular agenda, and they ended up published, and they ended up famous, and the little people are the ones who I quote. I quote the scholars and the eyewitnesses who were actually there but were rubbed out of history. All right, this is my method. Rabbi Antelman is one of those people. You think his book is found in any synagogue library? Now, this gets tricky. It all gets tricky because we're telling a very broad story. But I'm going to tell you the story of Wilhelm. Count Wilhelm? Leader of Germany, First World War.
Okay.
What was his name? Wilhelm was his.
Reich, or I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
No, no, it wasn't Count Wilhelm. It was. What's wrong with me? I mean, this is something I've done 100 lectures on. Wilhelm, the leader of Germany. You know, it's actually bothering me that his title, I forgot his title. Embarrassing, very embarrassing. Nonetheless, Wilhelm, the leader of Germany. I hear noises.
That's my cell phone.
Right. Wilhelm, the leader of Germany, arrives in Jerusalem in 1896. Now, believe me, nobody took a vacation to Jerusalem in 1896. The country was barbaric. If you didn't have armed guards, the bandits would get you. All the roads were barely goat trails. It was not the kind of place a world leader ever came to visit. But Wilhelm did come to Jerusalem in 1896, and so did Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism. And they met on November 2nd of 1896, and it's undoubtedly the most important meeting of Zionist history. Herzl is in Jerusalem. Wilhelm is in Jerusalem. But it's all rubbed out. Now, I unrubbed it as best I could because something happened at that meeting that changed the world. Now, why Wilhelm was there, we know about. The Ottoman Turks allowed Wilhelm to build three churches. But one is very important. It's the church on Mount Zion called the Domitian Abbey. In 1896, he arrived in Jerusalem to start the building. Well, if you've been to Jerusalem, you know where Mount Zion is. It dominates the skyline of Jerusalem, certainly in 1896. When there was no skyline, it would have been the only thing dominating the skyline was the Church of the Domitian. Now, the British already had put up a church, the Scottish church, and nothing like it. You could barely find it on the side of a hill on the other side of Mount Zion. The Germans had what they had done for Catholicism. Now, this is one heck of an understanding, but the Vatican believes Jerusalem is their capital, and they have never accepted that they were thrown out of Jerusalem. We have to go back to Charlemagne, who was the Holy Roman Emperor of the Germanic nation. He made Western Europe Catholic. All right, this is essential. Everyone says this to me. Come on, the Vatican can't have all that influence. They don't have an army. They sure do have an army. They have the German army. They have the Italian army. They have the French army. They have the Spanish army. They got armies all over Europe. Catholic Europe goes to war, especially Germany. I mean, the Germans, Napoleon said that they were hatched out of cannonballs. And that is certainly not the Italians. The Italians, you reluctantly make them into warriors. The Germans love it. When Charlemagne captured Europe in the 8th century, he built a cathedral in Aachen. It's still up. You can still go see it. It was in celebration of Europe becoming Catholic. That was rebuilt in Jerusalem. I show this at my lectures, by the way. It's the same church. He put it up in Jerusalem. It was an announcement by the Vatican that we were back in Jerusalem and we had established ourselves on the highest peak, on the holiest mountain, And again, so we don't get lost, nothing has changed. The current Wehrmacht volunteer Pope just came back from Israel, where Shimon Peres had long promised him Mount Zion as their sovereign enclave. There are tremendous, horrible battles for the people of Israel, but nonetheless, the Vatican is a major, major player in the breakdown of the modern state of Israel and the uplifting of the completely false Palestinian state. And God knows what can ever be done now because it's so instilled in the minds of the world that the Palestinians have an equal claim to Israel. Who knows if this can ever be sorted out? I strongly doubt it. But now let's go back to the meeting between Herzl and Wilhelm.
Sounds good.
Look on the internet and you will discover something. Herzl was rebuffed. Everywhere you look, Herzl was rebuffed. Now, come on, you have to understand what a trip Herzl must have taken to meet Wilhelm. There's stuff that goes before this. He also followed Wilhelm to Constantinople, but we don't need to know that. We need to know that taking a donkey trail from Yafo to get to Jerusalem was not something that anyone in their right mind would have done in 1896, but Herzl did. And the only reason he would be meeting Wilhelm in Jerusalem was to get a state. That's the only reason the father of Zionism would follow Wilhelm to Jerusalem. And the only way to get a state was to declare war on the Ottoman Turks or come somehow to a peaceful deal with the Ottoman Turks to give a small slice of their empire for a Jewish state. The Ottoman Turks had declared they're not willing to. That would have left war. And what Wilhelm must have told Herzl was, we made a pact with the Turks. You're not going to get your state. We're not going to go to war. We're getting our churches. We're happy with them. We are now an ally of the Ottomans. That's what he had to have told Herzl. Herzl left what would become Israel, and the British were very, very displeased. What Herzl had to have said is, it can't be done. We can't go to war with a German-Turkish alliance. It would kill untold millions of people. The British didn't want to hear that because Sabbateanism could only work if they got Israel back. It would only work that way. But Herzl had an idea that was not very popular. Move Israel to one of your British colonies in Africa. He suggested Uganda, which would have been actually worse. A worse decision than Israel, to move Israel to Uganda, but that's what Herzl was now pushing, because the alternative was a war with Germany and Turkey to get Israel back. And Herzl, by pushing this new line, this was his new Zionism. By the way, Herzl, from all my readings, was a good guy. He didn't want a war. Well, what became World War I over Israel? He didn't want millions of people dying. He had a peaceful solution. Give us Uganda, which would have been, you know, Rhodesia. It would have been a bad solution as well, but neither here nor there. What it comes down to is that Herzl suddenly died. Now, again, the Jewish myth is that Herschel worked so hard that one day his heart stopped beating. That's the Jewish Zionist myth, how Herschel died. Age 44, in the year 1905, Herschel went into a sanatorium in Paris where I looked at all the records I could find on the internet. Nobody says he went in for a heart condition. As a matter of fact, I couldn't even find why he went into a sanatorium, but in those days the odds were tuberculosis. Nonetheless, he never came out of the sanatorium. That was the end of Herschel. And without proof, but a lot of circumstantial evidence, the father of Zionism was murdered.
Real quick, that's obviously considered the father of Zionism in all the history books and stuff like that. There was some question, if I understood right, that he actually wasn't even the guy that wrote the book about that.
Yeah, there's real problems. Herschel claimed he wrote Judenstadt, the Jewish state, while he was in Paris. What was the year? 1891 or something. Neither here nor there, he was not in Paris when he claimed he wrote the book in Paris. There are lots of problems. He was not a very good writer before he wrote this book. And by the way, you can only find text messages of entire plays that he wrote before he wrote the Judenstadt. That also disappeared from Jewish history. But he was known to be a pretty bad writer, and the Judenstadt is brilliant. So we can guess that he was chosen because he was handsome and charismatic and all kinds of other reasons, but that's irrelevant. More to the point was he didn't want a war over Palestine.
Okay.
But you got the war. In 1914, the British declared war on Germany and Turkey, and 20 million people died. And in 1917, diverting like a million troops, badly needed troops, from Europe, the British took the Middle East, and Allenby walked into Jerusalem. And as Allenby walked into Jerusalem, well, you had Arthur Balfour sending a letter to Lord Lionel Rothschild, looking with favor upon the establishment of a Jewish homeland in their historical land, and that's it. That's the beginning of official. Well, that's really the official beginning of Israel, is when the British captured Jerusalem in 1917. And their foreign minister, Arthur Balfour, sent a letter to Lionel Rothschild looking with favor on the establishment of, well, they call it the Jewish homeland. What it comes down to is the Jewish state was founded. And only 20 million people had to die over this because Herschel was rebuffed in 1896 by Count Wilhelm.
So what was Rothschild's claim to the land of Israel at that point? What was he doing?
Well, I don't think it was necessarily Rothschild, but Rothschild had been building up Israel. The Rothschilds founded the first city in Israel, Rishon LeZion, built the Knesset, and incidentally built that gaudy, scary Illuminati Supreme Court building in Jerusalem, with the pyramid and the all-seeing eye and the obelisk, the whole thing. That's all Rothschild money. So their point of view is very straightforward. And by the way, well, straightforward. They wanted a Sabbatean state, and we'll get to that. And they're promoting the Sabbatean state in Israel to this day. But you have to understand, the Rothschild family were not united. It was the French Rothschilds that put up most of the money, and with some British contributions, but it was largely the French branch that built Israel.
So they didn't necessarily have any ties to the British Jewish League or whatever that was called? The people that the British
Jews... The British Israel Federations and Associations, all of this had tremendous ties to the Rothschilds, but I can't prove it, so I don't say it.
Okay.
Okay, I have no doubt that the whole... Look... Let's carry on while we can carry on.
Okay.
there's so much history that is so misunderstood. Now, I'm going to jump to 1933. You've now got, in Israel, you've now got a community, but it's not very big. The figure was about 600,000, which is still pretty significant. Considering, 33, I'd say 40 years ago, there were only a few thousand Jews, secular Jews. There was a large community of religious Jews in Israel, but there were no Zionists 40 years before, and now they're up to about 600,000 people. Now, you have to understand that the Jews in the 19th century, with the majority of the population in Palestine, or whatever, that's what's called now, and so we'll live with it. Jerusalem was majority Jewish by a long shot in the 1850s, same with Sfat and Tiberias, but you didn't have secular Jews. You didn't have people coming back to their land to rebuild the sovereign nation of Israel, until, the 1890s is when it began. 1917 is when the British recognized it. And by 1933, there was an amazing 600,000, Jews in Israel. And they cut a deal with the Nazis, the Jewish agency, under the butcher, Chaim Weizmann, cut a deal with the Nazis. They were short of people. By the way, the figure, I take back 600,000. It was 600,000 after the transfer agreement. Now, look, this is a real-for-real agreement between the Jewish agency representing the only Zionism of, is this complicated. Let's just say that the Jewish agency under Chaim Weizmann cut a deal with the Nazis. You make life miserable for the Jews and send them to Israel, and there will be no boycotts against the Nazis. There will be we will spend your money. The immigrants will have to buy German goods. We will support the Nazi regime. Just make sure you make life so miserable for the Jews of Germany that they have to come to Israel. That is a summary of the transfer agreement. Go look, go buy my books, go into my website, or Google transfer agreement. I'd rather you read it from me than from someone else, but that's what the Sabbateans did. They cut a deal with the Nazis. And in 1932, 250 Jewish organizations in Germany represented Jews. In 1934, all but one were banned. Labor Zionism was the only Jewish organization allowed in Nazi Germany. The Sabbateans had taken over. They were training mostly young German Jews to come to Israel in their training camps. They knew a Holocaust was coming. Chaim Weizmann addressed the World Zionist Congress in 1936, saying when the Holocaust is over, the people remaining will be strong and good for Eretz Israel. They were conniving to kill the Jews of Europe with the Nazis so that they could start as new Judaism, Sabbatean Judaism in Israel, using the seed stock of the German Jews that the Nazis were sending to Israel. Now, something very strange happened in 1939. The British, who were controlling Palestine, blocked all Jews from coming into the country. Germany had sent 70 to 80,000 Jews. Israel had now become a little German Jewish state with little symphonies and little coffee houses. The whole nature of Israel had changed from 33 to 39, and the British blocked practically all immigration in their famous white paper. Just as the war broke out, the Jews of Europe were trapped. They had nowhere to go. The British arranged the Holocaust in their own way. The Germans were the trigger men. They had the sadism, the natural ability to kill, which not every people, even in their most dire circumstances, has. Certainly not the Jews. In our very, very long history, committing mass genocide is not part of it. What it comes down to is the Germans prevented any Jew from escaping to, well, Israel. It was still Palestine, but the Jewish agency were aiding and abetting the Nazis and making sure these nasty religious right-wing Polish, Estonian, Hungarian, wherever they were from, they could not even be snuck into Israel because the Jewish agency wouldn't allow it. Now, I've written an awful lot about this, and I've got an awful lot of proof, and it's a whole different story. It's the story of Ben Hecht and the book Perfidy and the proof that the Jewish agency allowed 800,000 Hungarian Jews to be sent to the gas chamber. It's a long, ugly, horrible story.
Quickly, tell me which books I can find those, and I'll link them in the show notes of this website, all your books at tululu.com. So which books would people find, look for?
Well, I'll give you two, but there's lots of them there. Perfidy by Ben Hecht. That's a classic. Here are the two classics of what I'm talking about. Perfidy, Ben Hecht. Ben Hecht was a Hollywood screenwriter. He wrote The Front Page. That's his most famous film, but a lot more. And The Transfer Agreement by Edwin Black, former reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Those are the most famous sources of this awful, awful story.
Okay.
It's the betrayal of Jews, of all the Jews, by people claiming to be Jewish, but they're not. They're Sabbatean.
So,
and if you see a lot of Jews in the higher ranks the classic diplomatic conspiracy center, the CFR, you have to know what I said before. This is controlled, by the Sabbateans in ways that I can't begin to describe right now. It's a different topic.
Sure. Well, could you give me a few examples of how it is that, like, the religious Jews would be persecuted by the system?
The settlements in Israel, if you're a religious Jew, an Orthodox Jew, you are... I'm going to give you one example. This week, there were two car accidents outside the settlement of Efrat. One almost killed Daniel Matar. He is the wife and the husband of Nadia Matar, the leading pro-settlement protester. He was almost killed. The next day, Yaakov Citrin, whose father almost exposed the whole Rabin assassination. Their family has been under constant siege, almost died. His friend did die in a car crash, the same spot. If you're religious, it's and you care about Israel, and you cannot be bribed or corrupted, which, by the way, plenty of them can be. I mean, you have to watch for your life. They've been knocking off the finest free thinkers and rabbis in the religious world to bring forth this so-called peace, this Oslo peace. They have been killing the religious of Israel. But again, even the religious, they can't acknowledge the murders have been so constant, and I've been writing about them for years, and they're so obvious, but there's something wrong with the Jews. I don't know what it is. It's something in their mentality that wants to self-destruct. You cannot, well, I wouldn't say everyone. I've got plenty of advocates in Israel, but not enough.
So, Mary, what is the... for lack of a better word, the end game. What are they hoping to accomplish in the modern state of Israel with
this? Well, that's
this?
Where the real problem comes. The Sabbateans did not get their Sabbatean state. Torah Judaism and religious Judaism, they know by all demographic surveys, is going to be Israel. And they could care less if Israel gets chopped up into nothing or not. The real problem with this so-called Oslo Peace Accord, and again, in my books, I've covered that well, like nobody's business. I mean, that's not the point. The core is this attack on the religious. That's what it is, to drive the religious out of their homes. Look, if you think this two-state solution was the only solution, you're very wrong. Very wrong. It's the only solution left, because that's what the powers that be have decided. There were plenty of attempts at reconciliation between the religious Jews and the religious Arabs. The Arabs saw tremendous advantages in the Jews returning to Israel for the region and for their pocketbooks. They killed Yisrael Dahan. The first assassination in Israel was by the Sabbateans against a religious Jew who was, in fact, working with religious Muslims to come up with a solution they could both live with. What people don't understand is bringing Arafat back into the equation, creating Hamas. In short, the Oslo so-called peace accord, or what you may call the roadmap, is a guaranteed end of Israel, and, well, need I say it, the chances of another Holocaust in Israel, whether by a missile with an atomic bomber on it, or whether by just winning a war against Israel, another 6 million Jews, their lives are simply at stake from everything we've stated before. Israel is likely to be eliminated thoroughly in the next 2 days to 20 years. You don't know when. But the fact remains, the Sabbateans who founded Israel failed in their mission to create a Sabbatean state, and the leadership of Israel has been playing ball with the worst enemies of Israel, which, again, you can call the Illuminati and the Sabbateans. I'll just say you call it the Vatican and you call it the CFR. Those are the two primary enemies of Israel right now, and my books show the plotting between these two groups, who, by the way, have the same ultimate goal. They just disagree on who takes what from the rubble, how this is going to be the end of Israel. And you know what? To get the Jews to understand this, I would say the odds of me succeeding are approximately the odds of putting a Mexican on the moon within a year.
Well, okay. Let me clarify something now. So you're saying that when we hear like this, the UN seems to be really, really serious about getting some sort of peace done really, really soon. So we can translate that as
why the UN? Who says anything about the UN?
Well, I mean, they have these like declarations that, you know, it's going to happen.
The UN is absolutely powerless.
Well, we're right, but what I'm saying is that should we translate these calls for peace now? We must have peace. It's absolutely necessary.
Who's calling for that?
Oh, you know
what I'm saying. The American administration of the Vatican.
Right. So does that translate to the end of Israel? Let's get this because it means – it spells the end of Israel if we can pass this quote-unquote
peace. Well, Israel's been chopping itself up. You have to look at the map of Israel in 1973 – where there was 47,000 square miles that Israel controlled, and again, compared to today, the terrorism was nothing back then. Now it's about 9,000 square miles. It's going to be chopped down. If the West Bank is turned over to PLO, it'll be down to 7,000 square miles. Israel's being chopped into non-existence right now. 7,000 square miles is, I guess, about the landmass of, well, Connecticut.
Okay, let me ask you this, and this will be the final thing, and I want to talk a little bit about your newest book, too. But let me ask you this about the Iran thing. It seems like, you know, terrorism is real, obviously, and Israel is under tremendous danger from all sides. But then we see this kind of, like, weird war drums being beat by not just JNet and all that stuff, but also Hillary Clinton, all this stuff. What is the reason for the disinformation or the war drums being beaten? That what do we can
yeah
we take?
Yeah, like Israel is going to unilaterally bomb Iran. Israel would have to overfly the American Air Force in Iraq or Saudi, the close American ally Saudi Arabia. Israel can't even get to Iran. This is absolute nonsense. The only way Israel could bomb Iran is if Russia or the Central America, one Central Asian Republic gave them an air base, which isn't going to happen. And or of course, you have a dogfight to knock down the American Air Force over Iraq. Israel is not going to attack Iran. This is utter nonsense. It cannot be done in ways that we know about. All right, the American administration is extremely hostile to Israel, extremely, and they backed Israel into a corner. And this nonsense about settlements can't expand, you may think that's nothing. Imagine if you, in your neighborhood, you couldn't expand. You had a couple of children, they want to move near to you, you're not allowed to build a house for them. Just imagine you were restricted, that your life was restricted to that. Israel is saying natural expansion. The Obama administration is saying get them damn settlers out of there. Like you're going to displace 300,000 people who have every right to be there. It's a first-class mess. It's a mess that may never be solved, but the problem is Israel is surrounded by rockets, surrounded by them. Hezbollah has, well, what I've been reading, about 40,000. Hamas will, again, the Egyptians will supply the Gaza Strip and Hamas with lots and lots of rockets. Israel's at war with Egypt, and nobody understands that as well. Syria has not just got rockets, they've got chemical, biological. They can put all kinds of stuff on the warheads. Israel is surrounded, 80,000 rockets at least. Israel cannot take a hit of 80,000 rockets. Can't do it. Right now, this has been going on, for 5-7 years, that the south of Israel is uninhabitable from Hamas rockets. A few years ago, Hezbollah attacked the north of Israel. everyone left. The place was uninhabitable. Wait till you see when the whole place becomes uninhabitable. And it's not, I'm not guessing here. There is a real chance that even limited conventional rocket attacks can bring down Israel.
Barry, you have been doing a lot of shows with Stan Monteith on Radio Liberty. And
yeah, sometimes
really
three
great.
Times a week.
And you've been doing some like research projects on there, and they're really informative on specific topics and about the latest that's going on, and you know, delving into the history and stuff like that. So that's a good place to keep up with what's going on as far as you know, just recent.
Sure, RadioLiberty.com. Listen online, and you'll see my latest interviews. Look, this interview that we just did is very complicated and confusing. And now, you know, nothing said against you, but you chose it. Most people will not be able, unless they listen over and over again and actually follow it up and actually get my books and so forth, they won't be able to follow it. It's an accurate rewriting of Jewish history. That's not an easy task for most people.
Right. But it's needed, and I think it, you know, shouldn't sell them short. I think it's just a matter of getting it out there, and I think that, you're doing a good job of that. It just, let's push it a little bit harder, see if we can get it to more and more people. That's really the best thing.
Well, I appreciate that, and I certainly hear an optimism in your voice that you actually believe it'll help, and sure, why not? Maybe you're right.
Okay. All right, Barry, well, why don't you give out your information one more time, your email address and website, and we'll call it an interview.
How long was that?
I got about 1 hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah, that's as much as I can do. That's almost a two-hour interview. So that being the case, you buy my books at www.lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. You'll see a search box. Punch in books and write CHAMISH. That's Chamish. And in this case, for this interview, Shabbat Tzvi Labor Zionism and the Holocaust, as well as The Compromised Land, are your books. My website is www.barrychamish.com. And if you care to actually order my DVDs or book me, I'll leave a phone number, 904-315-8079.